Let me start by saying I am not from the United States of America. I was born in Nicaragua. My skin, while brown, is of a lighter tone. So even when I came to the US as a 15-year-old, I never perceived any prejudice against me. Everyone who I encounter from blue states like California or Maryland, red states like Tennessee and Georgia, or even purple states or swing states like Michigan, was respectful towards me. I interacted with Americans, black, white, brown, Latin, Native, Asian, and never seemed to have replicated what I had seen on the media. So I want to commence by saying that my understanding of American racism has been limited. Yet in the news, the media, and the experiences of friends of mine, I will link to an excellent blog by Philip Warfield about one of his experiences. I continue to hear this atrocious word, racism. So I journeyed to Virginia to talk with Daniel Schisto, a pastor, a father, and a recovering racist. So let us commence with a short definition.
A racism is anything that puts someone down, either personally or systematically, because of the color of their skin.
Now, as I said, that is a very short definition, one that allows for racism to be against anyone, regardless of the color of their skin. Yet in the news or the media, you usually see the word racism pointed towards a specific kind of color group, black or brown people. And now with the coronavirus health crisis, there are more reports in the media about people being racist towards those of Asian descent. So I asked Daniel to give us an example of what is the difference between prejudice, in other words, having ill feelings towards people who are not familiar to you, and the racism that the media speaks of, the one of a systemic kind.
Yeah, so there's this really good book called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, in which she draws the picture, or connects the dots quite convincingly, starting with slavery, moving into Jim Crow, where there was legal segregation, where facilities for whites was, you know, much better than facilities for blacks, straight down to today with mass incarceration. So that is an undeniable, if you just look at it from a numbers perspective, consequence or legacy or, you know, effect of racism in America is that, you know, black and brown people are being sent to prison, not because statistically they are more violent or statistically they are more prone to commit crimes, because we've seen that that's not true, but they are getting pulled over more, they're getting, you know, stopped and frisked more, they're getting all these types of things which are, you know, sending them to prison at a higher rate. Another example also is disparages between like certain types of crimes. For example, there is crack and cocaine, and crack is like a cheaper version, and cocaine is kind of like the rich man's drug. Statistically, black people have had lower income for reasons that are part of all that we're talking about. And so they tend more to be on the crack side, who do drugs, and white people are on the cocaine. So same exact drug, but the sentencing for those with crack was much more strict, was stricter than the sentencing for those with possession or use of cocaine. And those people are typically white. So why is that a disparage? Why aren't there equal sentencing matters? So that's like one example.
That question, the question of why, is the most important one. Why is somebody who is committing the same crime receiving a longer sentencing? I think that's a very pertinent question to our discussion of racism. Yet another thing that we need to reflect on is the word itself. What are some of the reactions that people have when they hear the word racism? These are the reactions that Daniel has seen with his friends.
I appreciate that. And from my experience, I've seen as soon as you say the word race or racism or racist in front of white people, it's like they're triggered. Their heart starts beating a little quicker and the defense shoots up and they get a little nervous. And they do what you say they do, and they say, oh, well, that was just an issue of the past. Let's just forget it. We're not there anymore. We elected a black president. Everything is fine. And so I've seen in my experience, in my personal conversations, that happens 9 out of 10 times with a white person. And when I say race or racism or racist around my black friends, they don't have that. That the defense doesn't shoot up. They don't get nervous. Their heart doesn't beat quicker. But what they do is they're like, yeah, I know. And then they start sharing a story. So I think it's lived experience why it is that people have the different reactions that you asked about. Some people have a lived experience where they deal with racism on a day in and a day out basis. Other people don't. And so they don't want to be uncomfortable. They don't want to be inconvenienced. They don't want to, you know, feel bad about themselves. And so like the defenses go up and say, no, 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 everything is good around here when we know it's not.
So let's test our knowledge about racism with a practical example. As I was riding to Daniel's house on a Lyft, I asked my driver about his previous job. What did he do before driving passengers on his Ford Escape from place to place? Passing by the semaphores of the Virginia Highway, he started to relate story after story where people of African descent, whether African Americans or transplanted Africans, were rude to him. He continued saying every time that the people who had given him the most trouble during his time in the United States as a healthcare assistant or as a Lyft driver were black people. Now he mentioned that he did not think that it was because they were of a darker skin tone, but fortuitously, it seemed to me at least, most of his negative experience, either in Lyft drives or in his previous experience, were with people of African descent. He even mentioned that he doesn't like to drive around black neighborhoods during late hours of the night because of issues that he has had in the past. So, dear listener, I ask you, is this person being racist? I'll leave it for you to ponder, and we'll be right back with Daniel's answer. Thank you for listening to Disruptive Adventism. We're back with more Disruptive Adventism. Today we're talking with a recovering racist, Daniel Chisto. Before the break, I left you with a practical example and asked for your opinion. You may DM us with that opinion or participate on our social media polls. But here is Daniel's answer to our real life example.
I believe it is. And if we were to just turn that situation around and he not be the one, you know, talking about his personal experiences being, you know, bad with racism, which I'd want to dig into. Why? Is there something about him? Is he doing something to provoke, knowingly or unknowingly, to have these bad experiences? But besides that, you know, imagine you were to turn the tables around and be like, wow, you know, I totally hear what you're saying. And yeah, it doesn't sound like you're racist. It's just your personal experience. But my personal experience is that, you know, whenever I've interacted with people of Asian descent, it's been very bad. And then you were to just go on like, you know, 5 or 6 examples of very bad experiences you've had with Asian people. I wonder how he would feel about that. I wonder if he would be like, yo, what's up with this guy? This guy's racist. Why is he talking like this? Does he think like I'm that way? And so what if you were like, yeah, I've had all these bad experiences with people who are Asian, so please pull over the car because I want to get out of the car right now and I'm not going to pay you and I'm going to give you a bad review on Uber. You know, I'm sure he would have a very different feel if you were to ask him, so, hey, this is just my personal experience. Do you think I'm racist? This is just my personal experience. So, yeah, that's your personal experience, but there's more to dig in there, even though it's just your personal experience. Why? What's going on in those individual things?
We come back to that question, the helpful question of why? Why is this happening? Why do we have this prejudice? What is going on in our lives? But even beyond those questions, we have to know how to navigate through the personal experiences of people. People have had negative experiences, let it be Black people with white people, or white people with Black people, or Latin Americans with Asians, or Asians with whites, or whatever it is. People have had negative experiences and positive experiences with different groups of people. So how do we navigate through that? Daniel tells us his answer.
I have two comments on that. The first is that there's a power dynamic at play. So with, like, you know, women who have had bad experiences with men, I see that, you know, as men having power over women in many different respects. And so there's that. And so there's also in race dynamics, white people have had and still do have power over Black people. And so when there is this power dynamic, we have to take that into account. Second, with people who've had bad experiences, I have a story that touches on exactly this. So my wife is Black, and I'm white, and she was at a store just a block away from the church that I pastor. And there has been a rash of break-ins and, you know, theft and that kind of thing in Tacoma Park. And there have been a few videos of people breaking into stores that have been shared amongst the small business owners, me included, as pastor of the Tacoma Park Church. And so, like, two or three, not all of them, but two or three of these videos were African Americans who broke into the store and stole whatever they stole. And so my wife, and this had just happened in the last week or two. So my wife, who's African American, she goes into this store and she's greeted by the owner. And he says, "You could look around as long as you don't shoplift anything." And my wife, who is a grown woman, a mother, a PhD graduate, you know, all these accolades she has, she was reduced instantaneously to a shoplifter right across the street from where I passed her. And so this guy, this owner may have seen these couple of videos of a few African Americans who broke into the store, and, you know, now he sees another African American woman walking into the store, and he just can't say that. It's just not right, even though he's had these personal experiences. Because, you know, if we were to just go by the images that we see on media, you know, when she sees him at the door, what is she going to say? "Oh, you know, is it okay if I come in here? You look like a mass shooter," because mass shooters are all white, older white men. Or, so it's like, we can't reduce ourselves to, you know, stereotyping in a way that, you know, disqualifies people before we even, you know, have a chance to interact with them.
Daniel mentioned there something helpful for us. We cannot reduce people to the images that we have seen, the images that have been fed to us. So I asked him, what is something that we can do to reshape those images, to change our perspective about others?
I think we have to create new images. We have to tell new stories. Like, for example, here in the South, there are thousands of monuments commemorating the Confederacy. And so why are those the only statues around? Why can't we have statues of MLK, of, you know, Bryan Stevenson, who's doing amazing things? He's doing, like, prophetic work in setting people. He, Harvard graduate, Harvard Law School graduate, going, taking cases to the Supreme Court, you know, showing the mockery that some of these death penalty cases are. Why aren't we celebrating more people like this? You know, and right now it's Black History Month's gonna start tomorrow. And it's like, you know, maybe for a few days or a few weekends, we think about these things a little bit more. But a lot of people don't, even on Black History Month. So I think part of the way to break the cycle are new images, new stories, celebrating new heroes that aren't just old white men who, you know, have a lot of skeletons in their closet. I think the second thing too is to befriend people. And more so than, you know, your coworker at friend is black. And so now you could say, well, I'm not racist because I have a black friend. Even though you really don't know your coworker, you've never asked them, hey, what has been your experience with race? I think that would be huge. That would go so far if more of our white brothers and sisters would ask more of our black and brown brothers and sisters, what has been your experience with race? And to hear firsthand, not, you know, in an article, not on TV, but to hear someone sitting across the table, looking at you in your eyes, telling you how they have been impacted, telling you how they have been marginalized and how they have been, you know, oppressed and hurt by this thing. Well, if that's your coworker and you kind of thought he was a nice guy and then he's telling you something that has impacted him so severely, I think that goes a long way into changing the narrative and making new ground.
So interacting with others and listening to their stories can help us get rid of our racist views and prejudice that we have in our hearts. Daniel even had to get rid of some of his views as he started his journey of recovering from racism. Here's Daniel with a story, and after that, a message from one of our sponsors.
So I grew up in a Catholic environment. My family is Catholic, Portuguese, very Catholic-oriented community. So I grew up Catholic. As a good Catholic boy, I went to Catholic school. And my Catholic school was like 99% white. So there was this one black student in our class, Patrick. Man, I'll never forget Patrick. And we, as elementary school kids, would pick on Patrick. And I had no idea why we were picking on him. I just knew he was kind of different. And even in my young mind, I still didn't know, you know, black and white, but I knew he was different and everyone else was picking on him. So I was going to pick on him too. And we did some really bad stuff to Patrick. And I feel so bad. And, you know, that was an instance where I was totally on the wrong side of history. And so I carry that image of Patrick now with me, saying, I don't even know how to get in touch with him. I don't know his last name. You know, go to Facebook, you type in Patrick, 5 million people will come up. And so I want to reach out to Patrick and say I'm sorry for the things that I've done. There's no way that I could reach Patrick, but maybe in what I do now and the work that I try to do and how I try to advocate, I'll make this world better for Patrick's sons, you know.
Thank you for listening to Disruptive Adventism. Before we get into our final segment, I want to ask you to consider sharing this episode with someone else. Also, if you can, leave us a comment on our social media or review us on Apple Podcasts. So do one of those three. Either share it with someone else, leave us a comment on social media, or review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to get the word out there, to get new listeners, and to continue creating this amazing content. Now we get back to Daniel. So as Daniel shared, he had previous experiences of racism with Patrick. So a question that naturally arises for those of us who are evaluating racism today is, how do we know that he has actually changed? How do we know that someone has actually changed? How do we know if someone who has had negative bias or racist views towards people has truly left their ways? This is a common question in the Christian framework, as even the Bible portrays. How did the Jews know that Paul, who had been persecuting them, had actually changed? Here are two stories from Daniel.
And how you can test me is by, you know, seeing my life now. Am I walking the walk? Am I, you know, standing up for my family and friends who are Black? Am I doing the things that you could expect someone to do who has had an awakening moment? So, for example, it could be something really small or something much bigger. An example of a really small instance is when my wife and I and our son Max were at Costco. And we bought a whole bunch of stuff. It's like this super long line. Going to Costco is always an issue because it's like super packed. So we're in line. There's a family, an all white family, white dad, white mom, white 4-year-old in the cart seat. And the groceries are in the front and the kid is sitting in the cart seat. And if you know Costco, you'll know what I'm talking about, where your cart has to go one way when it gets to the cash register and you as the customer have to go on another way. You can't follow the cart. You have to go around the other side and pay. So this white mom, she doesn't want to take her kid out of the car seat, out of the cart, because he's comfortable playing there. So she just follows him where the cart goes, so she doesn't have to take him out, while the husband goes to the other side and he pays. And so the cash register let that family go. Then it came down to our turn. And the same exact thing, we don't want to take Max out of the car seat because it's a big hassle, then he'll start running around. He's comfortable, he's playing with his little toy in his car seat. So my wife follows the cart and I go around the other side to pay. But this time, this is the very next person, this is like 45 seconds later, the cash register, the cash attendant said, "Hey, you can't be back here." And she's like, "Well, my son is in the cart." It's like, no, you cannot be back here. And then she, you know, was confused. And that's where me as a white ally, I'll step into that process and interrupt, because like white people get noticed more, unfortunately, by other white people. So I said, "Excuse me, is there a problem?" It's like, "Yeah, she can't be back here." And then I said, "Why is it that that other woman just 45 seconds ago was able to be back here with her son, but my wife 45 seconds later cannot be back here with her son?" And he started, "I'm not racist." And the defenses shot up. And I didn't say anything. I didn't accuse him. I just asked him a question. I stated the facts and I asked him a question. Why? He had no answer. All he could do was stutter. And he's like, "Okay, this time is fine." But, and that's just one tiny instance. A larger instance is when I was pastoring in Charlottesville in 2017, and the KKK and other white supremacists came to town because there was a debate. We wanted to remove this statue of Robert E. Lee, Confederate general, from Charlottesville, because it was right in the middle of town, in the middle of this park where a lot of diverse people go, and they don't want to be reminded of Robert E. Lee every single day. They're trying to relax in the park. So the city voted the removal. Well, you know, that wasn't good for the KKK and white supremacists. So they came to Charlottesville in full regalia, wearing hoods and everything, in 2017, marching through the streets. And not only were they marching through the streets, they were marching through the streets with police escorts. The police were there to protect them. And I just think of a time where, you know, Black people were marching in the streets like in Selma. And they were not marching to hurt anybody. They were marching for equality. And the police were there too. But the police were there to be violent and beat up the Black people. Here, fast forward, how many years later, and the police are, you know, escorting the KKK because they have a right to parade their hate. And so anyway, long story short, white supremacists murdered a young woman just a mile and a half down the road from our church. And so we had a decision to make as a church. What are we going to do? I knew instantly we had to respond. It was a mile and a half away from our church. a young woman was killed at the hands of white supremacists. So we mobilized a group march between the white Seventh-day Adventist Church, the Black Seventh-day Adventist Church, and the Spanish Seventh-day Adventist Church. We all came together and we marched down the same street where that young woman was killed. And it was just a Holy Spirit moment that I don't have time to get into right now, but I will say that was an instance where we as white Seventh-day Adventists showed up as allies for our Black and brown friends who were being oppressed, literally killed in the streets.
Two great stories from Daniel that show us that it is possible to be redeemed. It is possible to be on a racist, picking on Patrick kind of side, and then come back and defend people and fight for people and be consistent in doing so. One last question before we close. We cannot leave this podcast without touching into religion and racism. Is our church, or can our church, be racist?
I feel comfortable sharing that I love my church. I have worked for the Seventh-day Adventist Church now for 7 years. I left a career where I was making more money, went to seminary where I was not making any money for 3 years, actually paying money. I paid my way through seminary. All because I love this church. So I'll start by saying that. And it's because I love this church that I could say that, yes, absolutely, we are racist. I don't say anything about the church that I don't say about myself. I already said that I am a recovering racist and I have racism in me that I still am trying to get out. And I do not think that the church gets a pass on this just because it's the church. Actually, unfortunately, I think because we are the church, we have been, in a way, behind the bell curve. We haven't been above the curve. We've been behind the curve in that we haven't gotten things right as quick as other groups have gotten things right, including the federal government. So, like, you know, the federal government deemed segregation as illegal while the Seventh-day Adventist Church General Conference was still segregated in certain ways. And we've heard stories of how the seminary where I studied was segregated. There was a cord in the chapel and Black people were not allowed to go beyond that cord. So there's stories like that. I definitely think that we struggle with issues of race. Even today, like some modern day examples that I could give, that I could think of just off the top, is we just had this MLK weekend event at Tacoma Park Church. It was really good. And we had a retired general conference attorney, general counsel for the general conference. And he used to work on issues of Sabbath observance and employment. So if you're working at Chipotle and your manager says, hey, I'm going to put you on the night shift on Friday, you have to work from noon to 10 p.m. All of a sudden, this guy is left in a crisis. Am I going to go to work on the night shift or am I going to observe the Sabbath? And so when that happens, we have attorneys, high-powered attorneys. They go march into court, three-piece suit, looking all sharp, and they defend that person's right to worship on the Sabbath and not work. And we have a really good system at that. But when Black people are being shot at a higher rate at the hands of the police, I always wonder, why don't we have these high-powered attorneys show up to court and defend these rights? Why are there always other groups that are defending Black people, but we are more concerned about my man who has to work for 3 hours the night shift at Chipotle? So I asked him that in the forum, and he quite candidly said, the reason that we are more concerned about the Sabbath observance over any issues of race is because it's divisive. We know everyone could get behind matters of Sabbath observance, but we know that not all of the brethren will get behind this matter of race. And so that in itself, that lack of courage to stand for something because it's right, it just breaks my heart. And he also shared that he went to court, he personally, when he was working for the General Conference, went to court to protect the rights of this group that was practicing Santeria, like voodoo and witchcraft and stuff. And he said that that was not something that everyone understood why he was doing, and that was kind of divisive. But he said, we have to protect this group's right to practice Santeria, because if, you know, the government could create this law that affects them, maybe we will be next. And so I'm thinking about the duplicity of this, where he's okay taking a stand for something that's divisive, for something like Santeria, because he could see in his eye, if they come for the Santeria folks today, then tomorrow it might be us, the Seventh-day Adventists. And so I don't know why he still hasn't connected, or any of us, a lot of us haven't connected the dots that, hey, if they're treating our black and brown brothers and sisters like this today, maybe they'll be treating us this way tomorrow. So it's like we, in this one instance, are associating ourselves more closely with the Santeria folks than our own Seventh-day Adventist church members who are black and brown, and it's sad that that is how it is.
A hard pill to swallow, but a necessary one. Yes, there's racism within our church, and we ought to work to eradicate it. I hope that you shared this podcast, and if you want to listen to more topics discussed with Daniel Shisto, head to patreon.com/disruptiveadventism and listen to the unedited version of the podcast. Here is Daniel's final word, and thank you for your support. We hope today's podcast opened your mind and that you decide to talk with others, love others, and most importantly, fight for others. After all, heaven and this earth is for everyone.
I appreciate our time together. And how I would end this, I guess, would be on this notion of language. And I think right now that people's language puts them into one of two categories. They're either racist or they're not racist. And I don't think that language is helpful. I would say a better category is you're either racist or you're anti-racist. You're actively fighting against systems and structures to effect change, to bring down racism. You're actively searching your own heart, finding the racism within yourself and expelling it. So if you just say you're not racist, that means you're racist, because you can't be sitting on the fence on this one. You're either on board with the anti-racism train or you're on board the racism train. It's just like what we think about salvation as Adventists. You are either saved or you're not saved. You're either going to heaven or you're not going to heaven. We are not Catholic. We do not believe in limbo, where you could just, you know, straddle the line. It's either one way or another. So I would encourage everyone to be anti-racist, not to just not be a not racist person, but to strive to be anti-racist, which is an active word. It helps you to actively search your heart, find the problem, and with the power of the Holy Spirit, root it out.